Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. As he prepared to leave the White House 50 years ago, President Harry Truman's approval rating had bottomed out at 23%. His own Democratic Party avoided him in the election of 1952, and when Dwight Eisenhower's limousine picked him up for the 1953 inauguration, Eisenhower didn't even get out of the car to greet him. All that began to change when Truman gave his farewell address, and that's the subject of our interview this week with Truman scholar Richard Kuykendall. But before we get to that, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on March 2, 1808, Congress ended the African slave trade. Following the American Revolution, all of the northern states attempted to abolish slavery. Some states were more radical than others, but it was usually the case that emancipation was a gradual process, with slaves being freed when they reached a given age, often in their 20s. In the South, the peculiar institution continued unabated because of the agrarian nature of the economy and its reliance on human labor. The invention of the cotton gin in 1793 made cotton king in the South, and the demand for slave labor increased dramatically. But a distinguishing feature of slavery in the United States, as opposed to slavery elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere, was its non-dependence on the importation of slaves from Africa. Slaves were born into the condition, and the practice of slavery became self-sustaining. From 1808, when the act prohibiting the importation of slaves came into power, until the beginning of the Civil War, the slave population in the South more than tripled. Great Britain banned its African slave trade in 1807, but the practice of trading African slaves to Cuba and Brazil continued. By 1865, the number of slaves shipped from Africa to the Americas reached over 12 million, with an estimated 1 million deaths en route.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, get ready to meet a new George Washington, one of America's leading liquor producers. Washington's distillery at his home, Mount Vernon, poured out 11,000 gallons a year at its peak. The average distillery at the time produced fewer than 1,000 gallons. In fact, Washington's liquor, mostly corn and rye whiskey, became one of the plantation's biggest moneymakers. Now, the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, which owns and operates the estate, is rebuilding the long-destroyed stills. This is a very important part of Washington's story, explains Esther White, director of archaeology at Mount Vernon. He was a good businessman, and it's an important part of 18th-century life. Washington got into the liquor business in 1797 after a new plantation manager convinced the recently retired president that he could make a lot of money at it. A first small batch was so successful that Washington built a large distillery featuring 5 stills and a staff of 8. It opened in 1798, a year before Washington died. This is Talking History.
Now, once in a while, I get a letter from some impatient person asking, why don't we get it over with? Why don't we issue an ultimatum? Make all-out war. Drop the atomic bomb. For most Americans, the answer is quite simple. We're not made that way. We are a moral people. Peace is our goal, with justice and freedom. We cannot, of our own free will, violate the very principles that we are striving to defend. The whole purpose of what we are doing is to prevent World War III. Starting a war is no way to make peace. But if anyone still thinks that just this once bad means can bring good ends, then let me remind you of this. We are living in the 8th year of the atomic age. We are not the only nation that is learning to unleash the power of the atom. A third world war might dig the grave not only of our communist opponents, but also of our own society, our world as well as theirs. Starting atomic war is totally unthinkable. for rational men.
On January 15, 1953, President Harry Truman delivered his farewell address to the nation. Our guest, historian and Truman scholar Richard Kuykendall, has described that address as a bold statement that challenged widely held views in Truman's time and anticipated what has become the dominant view of him in our time. Professor Kuykendall was in Independence, Missouri in January where he spoke at the Truman Presidential Museum and Library on the Truman Farewell Address, inaugurating that institution's 50th anniversary commemoration of that event. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
In what ways did Truman's farewell address challenge widely held views in his time?
Well, the polls suggested that most Americans regarded him as a failure, and the address clearly challenged that and began to turn public sentiment around.
And how did it anticipate what would become the dominant view then?
Well, beginning in the 1970s, Truman emerged as a national hero. I wouldn't say that he's free of critics now. He has some critics in the historical profession as well as elsewhere, but a lot of evidence suggests that he's widely admired and that there's a great deal of enthusiasm for him in the country. Politicians have been identifying with him for quite a while. There's an abundance of evidence along those lines.
Has it been a gradual process, or did it turn over at one particular point?
I think the collapse of the Nixon presidency began the process, and it moved forward very rapidly there in the middle of the 1970s. Among other people, Gerald Ford gave it a big boost after he became president. And it moved forward rapidly again in the early 90s with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and the collapse of the Soviet Union.
And did it change among historians and the general public, or one or the other, or did one precede the other? How did that work out?
Well, historians in the early 60s, mid-60s, became fairly positive in their interpretations of Truman as historical research got underway dealing with Truman. Though historians did split then in the late 60s, early 70s, and many historians, I think, were appalled that Truman had become a national hero. But by now, though some critics in the profession are still at work, critics of Truman, the dominant sentiment in the historical profession, as well as with the public, seems to be quite positive.
Okay, well, let's get back to the address itself. What were the major points that Truman made in his address?
The address emphasized foreign affairs and Truman's accomplishments in that area. The address suggested that Truman and his aides had learned the lessons of history and had avoided a repetition of past mistakes. By that, they meant mainly mistakes made in the 1920s and 1930s that they regarded as responsible for World War II, and that Truman had behaved in a very different way than the leaders in the United States and also in Western Europe had back in the 20s and 30s. Beyond that, the address predicted that the Cold War would end in a way favorable to the United States and the West. It would end with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it would end that way if the United States continued to pursue the policies that had been established under Truman's leadership. And it would end that way in part because there was a fatal flaw in the Soviet system that would contribute to the collapse of that system.
Okay, so we're in the middle of Cold War here, a challenge, a struggle, if you will, with the Soviet Union. You made reference to mistakes that were made in the 20s and the 30s. Maybe you could just be a little more specific. What mistakes in particular, and then how would that apply to our engagement with the Soviet Union?
Well, as Truman saw it, the first mistake had been the American rejection of participation in the League of Nations. And then beyond that, there was the mistake of military weakness during the 1920s and 30s, which was very important from Truman's point of view. And there was the failure to respond quickly and forcefully to Japanese expansion in the 1930s, and then the expansion of Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany in the mid and late 1930s.
Now, after World War I, a similar message was sent out. Wilson certainly sent out this message about the League of Nations, but the nation just wasn't ready to hear about that. Was the response different after World War II?
Yes, the country was strongly supportive of the idea of joining an international organization and providing leadership in the development of an organization. And Truman, as a senator, had been one of the champions of that in 43 and 44. Truman was also a champion of a strong military. There was not as much support for the military right after the war as there was for the building of an international organization.
Now, there were also issues, however, of economic matters and race relations. Did he bring those up in his address as well?
He did bring them up. But a feature of the address is the small amount of space devoted to those domestic issues. There are just a few sentences in contrast with the fairly substantial treatment of international matters. He did say that the United States had learned how to make their economic system work effectively. And he did express pride in his accomplishments in that area. And he expressed the idea of change in race relations. He saw an awakening of the American conscience in that area. And those were both the economic matters and the race relations matters, important elements in the Truman presidency. But the address didn't give them nearly as much attention as it gave to international affairs.
What was the general history of the economic situation during the Truman administration? What did he have to wrestle with? Was it all prosperity so he could just coast, or were there difficulties with which he had to deal?
Well, at the outset, there was a big fear that the United States would slip back into a depression. The idea was that the war, and especially the government spending that came with the war, had been the factor that finally had moved us out of the Depression. So what was going to happen when the war was no longer pressing us to spend vast sums? So there was a fear of a post-war depression, and the administration had to grapple with that possibility. And the United States, for a variety of reasons, avoided a post-war depression. And then with the coming of the Korean War, the economy moved forward very rapidly in Truman's years.
And there were similar issues, difficulties, if you will, in race relations, including a position that he took that led to an interesting development in the election of 48 and recent political squabbles that went on. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Truman came to office with some sympathy for the aspirations of black Americans for change in race relations. And the Cold War with the Soviet Union gave that sentiment a boost in his mind and in the minds of his lieutenants and in the minds of many of his countrymen. And in response to that, he made a number of moves as president. He came out, for example, in February of 1948 for the passage of broad civil rights legislation. That led to a split in the Democratic Party, and that split has received a lot of publicity lately with the retirement of Strom Thurmond, because Strom Thurmond became the leader of anti-Truman Democrats in 1948. They set up an independent party, and that party chose Strom Thurmond as the presidential candidate. Another area in race relations into which Truman was highly significant was the promotion of the desegregation of the armed forces. And, of course, we're seeing a lot about that these days because one of the beneficiaries of that was Colin Powell.
Okay, well, let me take you back to a comment you made earlier. You said quite early on that, you know, when Truman was leaving office, he certainly had low marks in terms of public opinion, yet things we've been talking about, race relations and foreign affairs, from the perspective of 2003 would perhaps tempt us to believe he was a great success. So let me take you back on what factors led to Truman's failure to achieve higher marks when he was leaving office.
The most important factor was the Korean War. That war was dragging on, and it was by 1951 highly controversial. There were various proposals as to how to end it. The most prominent proposal came from General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur challenged Truman, contrary to the ethic of the professional military person, and Truman fired him for that. But Truman couldn't find a way to bring the Korean War to an end. And Dwight Eisenhower made a good deal out of that in the 52 election, and he promised to go to Korea if he were elected. The promise implied that he would be able to do something that Truman hadn't been able to do, and the promise contributed to Eisenhower's impressive victory. Other factors were what people regarded as a high cost of living. There were charges of corruption in the federal government, and some people blamed Truman for that, pointed to his associations earlier with the Pendergast machine in Kansas City. And there were charges of communists in the federal government, and Truman was portrayed by his critics as weak on that issue.
So did Truman try to counter that with his farewell address?
He didn't talk at all about the communist in government issue. He didn't talk at all about the corruption in government issue. His response to the high cost of living was to point to how well the economy was going. He didn't explicitly confront the high cost of living question. He just pointed out that the American economy had never worked so well, and by that he meant that it was providing a high level of employment, and he suggested that income was distributed more fairly than ever before.
So why was the address important then?
Well, it was important to Truman and to the people that participated in the writing of the address because they wanted to make a challenge to this criticism, this widespread criticism of Truman. They wanted to suggest an alternative. And the address is important in the long run because much of what was said in the address worked out. Truman, for example, had suggested that if we pursued these policies that he would established, we would avoid World War III. Well, we have avoided World War III. And he suggested that if we pursued these policies and took advantage of what he called the fatal flaw of the communist system, eventually the Cold War would end in a way that was desirable from the American point of view. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, has happened.
Okay, and maybe that's where we'll leave it. That's a good point. So thank you for joining us, Richard.
Thank you very much, Brian.
You've been listening to Richard Kuykendall, Scott and Dorothy Bullitt Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Washington. For more information on the Truman Presidential Museum and Library's year-long commemoration of the Truman Farewell Address, visit the website at www.trumanlibrary.org. This is Talking History.
We've made progress in spreading the blessings of American life to all our people. There's been a tremendous awakening of American conscience on the great issues of civil rights, equal economic opportunities, equal rights of citizenship, and equal educational opportunities for all our people, whatever their race or religion or status of birth.
Continuing on the subject of this week's interview with Richard Kuykendall, we've chosen for our site of the week the Harry S. Truman Presidential Museum and Library. Here to provide an introduction to the museum and library is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
Located in Independence, Missouri, the Truman Presidential Museum and Library is dedicated to preserving Harry S. Truman's presidential papers and to educating the people about the man and his presidency. The museum collection consists of approximately 30,000 objects. It includes gifts to President and Mrs. Truman from heads of state, representing some of the finest decorative art from around the world. Gifts often of a simpler nature from the people, hand drawings, wood carvings, and other handicraft. Some of the Truman's personal possessions, including clothing, canes, membership cards, and more, campaign posters, ribbons, and literature, and objects related to the president's life and career, such as the table on which the United Nations Charter was signed, and a safety plug pulled from the atomic bomb dropped on Nagasaki. The museum's permanent exhibit, Harry S. Truman, The Presidential Years, features two decision theaters and enhanced audio and video programs. The American Presidency, A Glorious Burden, a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, closes May the 11th. An exhibit of World War II posters will be at the museum until July the 30th.
Thank you, Fiona. We conclude our program this week with two more excerpts from Harry Truman's farewell address. In the first clip, President Truman predicts when and how the Cold War would end.
Then some of you may ask, when and how will the Cold War end? I think I can answer that simply. The communist world has great resources, and it looks strong, but there is a fatal flaw in their society. Theirs is a godless system, a system of slavery. There is no freedom in it, no consent. The Iron Curtain, the secret police, the constant purges, all these are symptoms of a great basic weakness. The rulers fear of their own people. In the long run, the strength of our free society and our ideals will prevail over a system that has respect for neither God nor man. Last week, in my State of the Union message to the Congress, and I hope you'll all take time to read it, I explain how I think we will finally win through. As the free world goes stronger, more united, more attractive to men on both sides of the Iron Curtain, and as the Soviet hopes for easy expansion are blocked, then there will have to come a time of change in the Soviet world. Nobody can say for sure when that is going to be or exactly how it will come about, whether by revolution or trouble in the satellite states or by a change inside the Kremlin. Whether the communist rulers shift their policies of their own free will or whether the change comes about some other way, I have not a doubt in the world that the change will occur.
In the second audio clip from Harry Truman's farewell address, the president speaks about American prosperity.
But there are some other things we've done that history will record. One of them is that we in America have learned how to attain real prosperity for our people. We have 62.5 million people at work. Businessmen, farmers, laborers, white-collar people all have better incomes and more of the good things of life than ever before in the history of the world. There hasn't been a failure of an insured bank in nearly 9 years. No depositor has lost a cent in that period. And the income of our people has been fairly distributed, perhaps more so than at any other time in recent history.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We'd like to thank the folks at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Museum and Library for their assistance in developing this program. As always, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. And we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, produced by Joey Skidmore and assistant producer Fiona Beatty. You can learn more about the OAH and Talking History at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau, leaving you with some piano music by Harry Truman himself. ¶¶
Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians.